Reported by Grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers, and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It's Friday, February 20th, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Today on Geek Speak, we have one of the foremost experts on Photoshop. Right after the Geek News, we'll talk about the new features of Photoshop CS. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll be giving out those contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, programmer and student of American literature, and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing communications manager for Transmeta. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning.
Morning, Lyle.
Before we dive into our discussion of Photoshop CS, let's do some geek news. I'd like to start with you this morning, Sean.
Okay.
Hi.
Am I live?
You're live, man.
So flat panels are set to outpace CRTs in 2004. I don't know if you remember, but maybe 6 months to a year ago, there was a huge shortage of flat panels worldwide. Well, now there is a surplus in the Asian market. And they expect that that's going to drive flat panel sales up and overtake CRTs in 2004. So this would be the first time for global shipments that that could happen.
That's kind of exciting because CRTs, of course, are quite heavy and toxic.
I don't know how it suck up a lot more power too.
Take a lot more power. So
for those that don't know, the cathode ray tube, which is the CRT, is what most people see as a big boxy monitor.
Television
panels. It's thinner. It's lighter. It's better for your eyes. And 17-inch flat panel displays could be coming to you at a price tag of under $400,
which is reasonable for a monitor. Thank you very much, Sean. Miles, hi.
This is more in the political arena. The Union of Concerned Scientists have issued a statement accusing the Bush administration of distorting scientific fact and suppressing findings so that it will fit administration policies and politics. Their Union of Concerned Scientists is an independent organization that includes 20 Nobel Prize-winning laureates. Now, an example of what they were covering was a panel for the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, was having a report on lead poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to recommend strengthening regulations on lead levels because of new information on lead toxicity, and had their recommendations rejected by the administration. And two panel members were replaced by people who had ties to the lead industry.
Ooh, okay.
The Bush's science advisor, John Marburger, called the report biased and said he was troubled to see some very prestigious scientists had signed the statement. It's a kind of a back and forth there that, right, we don't like that idea. Let's get someone that's going to give us the right answer. But at the same time, you have 20 people that the scientific community has gone, these are really smart people.
All right. So you're just flagging this up for political purposes, right?
Well, yeah, but it's also just the importance that science is, the fact that science has taken a back seat in a lot of ways in our country today.
Okay. Thank you, Miles. Sean.
I thought I was with Democracy Now! For a moment.
Oh, shush.
Well, big news this week was Intel revealed 64-bit version of their processor. Now, you might think to yourself, well, they already have a 64-bit processor. That's the Itanium. Well, that's not the same 64-bit that's compatible with 32-bit systems around today. The same technology that AMD introduced last year.
So Intel, before this, had a 64-bit processor, but no code that was already designed for 32 could fit on the 64-bit. So you basically have all new code.
Yeah, the Itanium can run 32-bit software, current 32-bit x86 software, but it emulates it about 1/10 the processor speed.
So it wasn't
a viable solution for a lot of people.
So they released a new 64-bit, which is following the design of AMD.
It's not a new 64-bit. This is a 64-bit that AMD designed. AMD has named, early on it was x86-64. They renamed it to AMD-64. Well, Intel is now going to be producing a chip based on Prescott, which is the next generation Pentium 4 that we talked about last week, mm-hmm. with 64-bit extensions that are compatible with AMD-64. But they're not calling it AMD-64.
Right, of course. Well, that's interesting to see AMD kind of won that battle to some degree.
It certainly seems that way.
Do you know if there's any money flowing from Intel to AMD for that technology?
No. In fact, back in 95, there were a bunch of patents that went back and forth, and they're fully covered.
Okay.
So the reason why AMD can put out x86-based processors, now Intel can take advantage of that, too.
That makes sense. Well, thank you very much for that story.
But this could hurt them.
Yeah.
You know, the Itanium cells, because now Microsoft has to support 264-bit OSs, and they said they're not going to do that. And AMD's Opteron and Athlon 64-based processors are very popular now,
right?
Because they can run 32-bit OS and software. So
you might see Microsoft just going to the AMD solution, which is Intel's new solution.
It'll be interesting to see.
And killing the top.
Because a lot of big companies like Dell and HP are thoroughly invested in Intel 64-bit Itanium technology.
Well, thank you very much, Sean. Miles.
The HMS Beagle has been found.
Oh, yes, the satellite or lander.
No, the original one, the one, the namesake. The actual namesake, the original ship that Darwin took to the Galapagos Islands. And they found it bottom some Essex marshes. It's been sitting there for the last century. But in terms of Mars, there is some news there.
Okay.
Opportunity came across what looked to be water, traces of water. And Spirit, which was going to go a full 164 feet, which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're a few million miles away, it does make a difference.
Right.
Stopped to verify the findings, and what they're finding is that below the surface, there's a brine. It's actually what appears to be a liquid water, but it's extremely high saline content.
Mm-hmm.
So because there's so much salt, it doesn't freeze.
Oh, okay, makes sense. So it's kind of a slurry, if you will, salt slurry.
Right.
Cool.
Extremely salty. I mean, obviously, because it's so cold up there.
But. Of course. Sean?
TiVo is getting a huge boost in horsepower. They're going to be supporting high-definition televisions and broadcasts. They'll be supporting 250-gig hard drives, which is enough room to store 30 hours of high-definition programming and 200 hours of standard broadcast programming.
So, Sean, you've got the new Prius, and Miles has the old Prius, but you have the old TiVo, and Miles, you going to get a new TiVo?
Not if I can help it.
No.
But Chris Dunphy is.
Okay, so the new TiVo, basically, HDTV output, a lot larger hard drive support.
Yeah.
Anything else on the list of new features?
No. I think that's a pretty big one right there.
I think that's great. The idea of getting 35 hours of video storage on your TiVo. Wow.
So it'll support HD 1080i. That's the highest resolution HD broadcast.
Now, is this released now, or is it going to be out soon?
They just announced that they're going to be coming later this year.
All right.
But, I mean, it's good news because people who have been holding off on buying HD.
Right.
Now's the time.
Of course. Right.
Maybe this year.
Miles.
It looks like computers are moving in to replace musicians in the musical Les Miserables. It's causing a great deal of controversy among musicians.
I can imagine.
Quite obviously. And what it's going to do is have this computer synthesizer replace 11 musicians, which is supposed to be saving close to $10,000 per week. And so Les Mis is basically going to have 11 musicians and then another computer that instead of... One of the big concerns, though, is that it's going to sound boxy. You don't have the human flavor to it. You don't have the ability to, if something goes wrong, to be able to change what's going on. This computer apparently handles that to some extent.
And it's going to be playing with live musicians as well? There's still going to be some live musicians.
Right.
Interesting solution. Kind of sad to put musicians out of work. But if it's keeping Les Miserables up, I guess that's good.
Well, it's the third longest musical in
history.
In history. I mean,
I know it's tough. Thank you very much, Miles. Sean?
Yeah, Carnegie Mellon University has announced a new receptionist. Her name is Valerie. She was built over 2.5 years on a school-funded project, and she is a robo-receptionist. that interacts by talking about her boss, talks about her psychiatrist, and she dreams of being a lounge star.
So basically, this program that was going for 2.5 years, school-funded program, is to produce someone that can do receptionist work that is robot.
A robot receptionist.
Interesting.
I guess kind of like Jetsons, you know?
Well, to some degree, we have that in a lot of companies. The auto phone response system that redirects you to the right person, that's a lot of receptionist or traditional receptionist job. But this is more than that. You can also talk about the weather.
This is a blonde robot receptionist that interacts with you. And it's supposed to carry on all the typical duties of a receptionist.
So right there, we're getting rid of musicians in the world, we're getting rid of receptionists in the world. This is not good, folks.
No.
Miles?
Some quick astronomy news. I'll try to get to this pretty quickly. The telescope Chandra observation has seen a black hole rip a star apart. As the star approached it, the gravitational tidal forces tore the star apart, and its parts of it fed into the black hole, and other parts were spread about the rest of the galaxy.
And it's still hungry.
And it's still eating.
Is this the first time we've seen a star be ripped apart?
First time it's actually been observed, yes.
Wow,
it's been hypothesized, but never observed. See, Europa's ice fields have been found to be highly acidic, close to a pH of zero.
Not a friendly
They don't
place.
Know whether it has to do with its close or the radiation from Jupiter, or whether or not it's volcanic sulfuric acid coming up from the depths. And there's the galaxy's largest diamond, 10 billion trillion trillion carats. It's the center of a white dwarf star.
How far away is it?
It is 50 light years from Earth.
Darn.
So if you want to head out the door, you know, stick your hand out.
You can get it in about 400 years.
Completely destroy the Earthbound diamond market.
Right. Or if you got it back, which would take a little bit longer.
Miles
and Sean, thank you very much. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. Scott Kelby is the editor-in-chief of Photoshop User Magazine, editor-in-chief of Mac Design Magazine, editor-in-chief of Nikon Capture User Magazine, training director and lead instructor for Adobe Photoshop Seminar Tour, president of National Association of Photoshop Professionals, and author of a string of best-selling books. Most recently, he finished writing Photoshop CS Killer Tips, available from New Writers Press. Scott is joining us today to talk about the features of the new Photoshop CS and about the upcoming Photoshop World 2004. Photoshop World 2004 starts in March 1st, runs till the 3rd at the Moscone Center North. Scott Kelby, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, Lyle. I can barely hear you.
Okay, well, I'll try to speak up, but this is going to be difficult. So can you hear me now?
Not really.
Not really. That's not
good.
It sounds
like you're maybe 50, 60 feet away.
Well, that's not good at all. I don't know if I can change that, really.
Because you sound good.
I hear your guests great.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have the guests talk to you. How about that, Scott?
Oh, there we go.
Okay, great. We're on.
Oh, hey, there
Wonderful.
You are.
Scott, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure.
So you sound like you've just got a litany of work you're doing. I mean, tons of positions, editor-in-chief of this, that, and the other thing. I guess you would call yourself a lover of Photoshop?
Yeah. I never thought of it in that terms, but yeah, I guess I am a Photoshop guy.
Now, the geek equivalent, if a geek is the kind of the technology enthusiast, a Photoshop enthusiast is called what, a pixel jockey?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a term we use in the industry to describe someone that's really, they make their living using Photoshop.
And you make your living talking about Photoshop, right?
Yeah, basically I'm a trainer, instructor, author, kind of. Teach people Photoshop kind of guy.
Okay, now Photoshop World 2004, it's in San Francisco this year, but in the San Jose area. Photoshop was actually born in the San Jose area, correct? In the Silicon Valley area?
Yeah, it originally was, yeah.
And how long have you been working with Photoshop?
Actually, I got into it a little later than a lot of people. I think my first version of Photoshop I saw was 2.0.
Okay, and now we're up to Photoshop 8, but they're calling it, no, 9?
No, you're right.
It's exactly 8.
Right, 8, yeah.
But it's being called Photoshop CS for marketing reasons, not sure.
Right, for marketing reasons known only to Adobe, yeah.
But basically, it's Photoshop 8, and it's great. I mean, I personally use it. I think all the geeks have touched it and played with it a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the new features of Photoshop CS. What was, like, the thing that you were most happy to see in Photoshop CS that wasn't available in Photoshop 7?
Well, they added a lot of neat little stuff. For me personally, the thing that I like the best is not something that wasn't in Photoshop 7, but something that they fixed so dramatically in Photoshop CS that it's night and day between what they had, is the new file browser. And the file browser introduced in Photoshop 7, but in Photoshop CS, they made such a dramatic, sweeping improvement on it. It was everything that you would wish the file browser in Photoshop 7 was. It's now in Photoshop CS.
Now, I never really used the Photoshop browser in 7.
You did the right thing.
It was that bad, huh?
But it wasn't bad. It was one of those things where you worked with for 15 minutes and you went, wow, I wish you could do this. Boy, would this be great if you could make this bigger. Boy, wouldn't it be neat. It just, you used it for 10 minutes and then you hit the wall and you went, wow, they could just add these things. And that's what they did in CS.
So what is it? Describe it real quick for someone that's never used it
before. Someone that's never used it before. Basically, it's an application within an application. So it does enough things where honestly it could be its own freestanding application. But what it does is it lets you sort and categorize and basically organize your digital images all from within Photoshop itself. So you don't have to leave the program to launch another program or do something else to acquire and sort your images from your digital cameras or from your hard drive, for that matter.
Now, you're a Mac user, correct?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I'm primarily a Mac user.
How do you view the browser versus like iPhoto, which is Macintosh OS's kind of photo manager?
Oh, the file browser is on a whole other level than the iPhoto, which is a very nice. I mean, I like iPhoto. Don't get me wrong; it's a very nice consumer level tool. But that's the problem. It's very much like I just want to kind of sort some photos and show a slideshow. The Photoshop file browser is for serious professional photographers.
Okay.
And it can be used by amateurs as well, of course, but it's a serious tool that does serious, big, scary stuff.
Well, talk about a little bit, but what, besides being able to access your files from a visual perspective, like you're seeing kind of thumbnails of all the files and you can change
right.
the size of them, what are the things that it's doing that really enables you to work with your files better?
Here's a great example. The hottest thing right now in digital photography is shooting in what's called the format called RAW.
Okay.
And only the high-end digital cameras, you know, cameras that are like, let's say, $1,000 and up, shoot in this raw image format. And one of the things that Photoshop CS does, right through the file browser, is to let you actually open these raw images directly in Photoshop and, more importantly, let you process those images. And let me just give you a 30-second description of what that is. Right now, if you're a photographer shooting with regular film, you go and you take your film to, let's say, Walgreens or whatever, you know, whoever your processes your film. And then a kid sits at the machine, they decide how big your photos are going to be and how much color correction they're going to have, and then they hand you prints. Well, in the file browser, they allow you to be the kid at Walgreens. Basically, you open the negative, you go in there and you decide what your original print's going to be, and when you open it from the browser, another window opens called Camera Raw, where you make all the processing decisions that somebody in a photographic lab would make. And when you click OK, it creates a brand new original print.
Saving the raw file?
Yeah, that's right. In other words, okay. The raw is untouched. The raw is your digital master.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make as many prints and different variations and adjust the white balance and things that you should have done on the camera. If you forgot to open it up in f-stop, you can go and open it up in f-stop. It's amazing. It's like you can fix all the problems you've made on the shoot and then create a brand new original that doesn't have the problems that you did on the shoot. So
Now, why is this raw format only really supported on the high-end cameras?
Because, you know, the $200 and $300 cameras just... a year from now, will RAW be supported by those? Maybe. But right now, it's kind of, it's for high-end shooters because, number one, is only high-end serious photographers really care about the extreme quality that RAW offers.
Right.
RAW files are bigger, they're slower, you know, so the average person is going to go, well, do I really need that? But the pros are like, oh, I really need that.
So basically, when you're talking about using the file browser and just Photoshop in general to manage this kind of raw data, the camera, you know, the low-end cameras, the point-and-shoot kind of snap digital cameras, are doing that by themselves slightly intelligently, I would assume.
Well, yeah, I mean,
so
they're
what's the problem with letting the camera do that and then managing the file after the camera's done that? What's in that raw data file format that is so special?
Well, it's that it's basically untouched. For example, if you open up a photograph and you shot it wrong, you actually, the exposure is wrong, it's too dark. Well, you can go in Photoshop and try to tweak that, and if you're really good at color correction, you can do that. If you set the white balance wrong when you shot it on the little point-and-shoot cameras, if you're really good at Photoshop, you can go in there and try to change the white balance. But every time you do those, it damages the photo a little bit. Every time you make a big sweeping change in Photoshop, it literally degrades the quality of the photo. That's where RAW gets you. It doesn't degrade the image of the photo. You're working off the negative. So you can say, I want to change the white balance, and you just choose from a pop-up menu. I want to open up the exposure by 2 f-stops. Click OK, and you have a pristine original without any loss of quality.
Sounds very cool. All right, let's talk about another feature, the Match Color Command. What is Match Color Command?
Match Color Command is it's one of the most brilliant things. If you see it live, it just knocks you over. What it allows you to do is you open up one photo, let's say shot at sunset. You open up the same people shot at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And, of course, one's going to have very warm tones. It looks like sunsets, aiming, they've been shot in yellowish light. The other one's shot in the middle of the daylight. You say, I want to match the color of the sunset shot to the one of the daylight. You just open the two photos, choose match color. It looks at the colors and matches the two photos dead on the money.
And
amazing.
And what's the benefit of that from, it sounds like a cool, neat, but what's the benefit when you're editing photos and managing photos or when you're doing
the
work?
Where you really wind up using it. Let's say that you're shooting somebody for 20 minutes outside. And this you'll do this mostly when you're shooting outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
When you shoot over a period of 20 minutes, the sun's moving, the clouds are moving, and over this period of 20 minutes, a half hour or an hour, shooting the exact same people. When you look at the photos that you shoot at the beginning of the hour will look different than the ones you shoot at the end of the hour just because the clouds have moved and the sun's mm-hmm. moved and stuff. If you want all 20 photos to match, all you have to do is run through match color, and they will be dead on.
Very cool.
Look like you shot them all at the same moment.
Sean, please.
Is that a filter?
No, it's under the image menu, so it's kind of an image correction along the line of curves or levels. Then right there you'll see match color.
Okay.
And it's really pretty much a one-trick pony. I mean, you basically open one photo, say match it to this one, and click OK. It's brilliant.
Wow.
One other feature that I saw at Macworld that I thought was great was shadow highlight correction.
Oh.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, that's the one that's driving photographers. They're driving them up the wall. They love this thing. Basically what it is a lot of times you shoot a photograph. Let's just say that you shoot a photograph of your son. You're out, shooting a son, and the son's behind him. So although it looks great when you're looking at him right there in person, when you get the photo back, the son's behind him and his face is all in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to basically open up shadow and highlight, slide the slider to the right. It automatically just adjusts just the shadows. And it looks like you went in there with a fill flash and perfectly filled it in. It fixes a multitude of photography sins like no thing I've ever seen in Photoshop because you don't have to know anything. All you have to go is, it's too dark. You move the slider and it lightens up. It doesn't affect the background.
Now,
it only affects the shadows.
Now, to some extent, if you have a dark spot in your photo and the highlights are in the background, like that sunset in the background,
yep.
Sky in the background, and the dark shadow person in the front, when you're bringing out more depth of the color range in that person's face by lightening them, by using this filter, aren't you losing image quality in that person's face?
Well, here's the thing is, this is the photo you would throw away. I mean, literally, right. You open it up, your kid's in the dark, you just throw the photo away. So if you do lighten it up so dramatically that you start to lose the image quality. What you'll really wind up doing more than you losing image quality is the person's face will become oversaturated. Like if they had a nice skin tone when it was dark, by the time you move it up, sometimes their face looks too sad. Their face looks too red or too yellow.
Right.
So at the bottom of that dialog box of shadow and highlight, there's a button called Show More Options. If you click that, it unleashes this long list of options. At the bottom is one that's called color correction. What it really should be called is reduce saturation. And it's just a slider. You pull it to the left, and it takes that oversaturatedness away. But as far as damaging the photo, actually, I've had amazing luck with this thing. I can't tell you how many times and how many photos it's fixed so brilliantly and so easily because it only affects one area of the image. So I don't think it's as much as an image damager as an image saver.
Right. The one that you'd throw away, you don't have to now.
That's right. Yeah, you would have tossed it. Now you're like, hey, I'm going to keep this one.
It's great. I'm just trying it as you're speaking. It's kind of like a personal tour from you, and it's pretty cool.
Isn't that a great tool?
Yeah.
Here's where else you try it. I have a photo that we took of my son, and the light shining on his head. I mean, the sun's right above him. His whole head is just white. And that's where you use the highlight slider. As you pull the highlight slider over, it just takes that glow in his head and almost makes it go away, and you can see his hair again. So it works for shadows. You'll use it mostly for shadow problems because that's where people have the most problems. But for highlights, it works just as well, and it's just one slider.
And you get to this shadow and highlight thing by doing
It's under the image menu, under adjustments, right below curves and levels and all that. You'll see shadow / highlight.
Okay, another thing that's in that area is histograms. What the heck are histograms?
A histogram is basically, it's a graph. And it's a graph that Photoshop looks at your image and displays a graph that it would be like a graphic equalizer in your car.
Okay, for
so
sound.
If you could look at a song while it's playing, you could see the bass on one end, the mid range in the middle, and the treble.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a histogram is. Basically, it's a visual representation of what your photo sees. So if you look at that and where the bass would be, which is the shadows in Photoshop, if there's nothing there, it tells you, uh-oh, there's no shadows in your image, and you'll be able to move a slider over to fix and add shadows back in where they're gone.
Okay, assuming like the entire photo is too light kind of thing.
Yeah, you would be able to see that by looking at, yeah. You can look at the histogram and go, uh-oh. Because you're supposed to have a full range, just like you'd want your graphic equalizer. In your car, you want to hear bass, you want to hear mid-tones, you want to hear treble. When all three of those are present, your stereo sounds pretty good. Well, if you open up a photograph and there is no bass present, you know, if you look up at the histogram and it shows there's no bass, you know, your photo looks like your car would with no bass, with the bass speakers turned off.
And you can do histograms for light and dark, but you can also switch over to different colors. Is that true? You can represent red, for example?
Oh, yeah. Well, a color image is made up of red, green, and blue, three different channels. So you can ask the histogram to show you each channel in color. So you just see the red channel, just see the blue channel, and just see the green channel. And they let you see them in color so visually you know which color, which channel you're looking at. Because some problems only occur in certain channels, like noise. Like, you know how digital cameras, if you shoot in low light, the photos look really grainy?
Right.
Most of that grain just appears in the blue channel. So if you're trying to get rid of the grain, you would just work on the blue channel.
Very cool. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you have questions or comments for our guest about Photoshop, you're welcome to use the numbers 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. And our guest is Scott Kelby, Photoshop expert, I would say. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. If you want to use phone numbers to join our conversation, now's the time. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. We're taking any calls about photo manipulation using Photoshop, photos in general, using digital cameras, and any other questions you think that our expert on Photoshop would be able to handle, specifically questions about the new Photoshop CS. So, Scott, histogram palette changed in Photoshop CS. What's changed about it?
Well, they actually made a whole separate floating palette. It used to be part of the levels. Pardon me. If you use the levels command, you actually saw a histogram.
Right.
And now they have a whole separate floating histogram palette, and it's much more powerful, and it's become when you're using curves and things now, you can use it. In fact, it's become such a powerful tool that at Photoshop World, which is our annual convention, there's actually a whole class just on using this histogram palette and how it will change the way you work in Photoshop. So it's for color correction purposes, it's a very, very significant move ahead in the color correction process, being able to visually see what you do as you do it.
And how do you get to the histogram palette?
Histogram palette? Oh, boy.
Do you know?
I think it's under the window menu because it's a palette. Most of the palettes are listed under there alphabetically. I don't have Photoshop.
There they are.
Open.
You're right. It is there.
Okay. Can you adjust the histogram from that palette?
I'm sorry?
Can you adjust the histogram from that palette?
No, it just gives you a visual readout. You would use it when you're making adjustments in something like curves.
I see.
The main tool for professional color correction is curves. But the problem is when you're using curves, you don't get a histogram.
I see.
So now you can have curves open and a little histogram palette at the same time. So as you're making adjustments, you actually see the histogram. You're like, that's what's happening.
Yeah, that's right. It does. It works quite well. It's a wonderful feature. When you're going to be doing the keynote for this event that's coming up.
Right, yeah.
And I'm assuming you're involved pretty much all the time because you're president of an organization that actually runs Photoshop World.
Yeah, and the keynote falls under one of the things that's under my charge, so.
Okay, so you're
I'll be sharing the stage with Adobe, actually.
And who from Adobe will be joining you?
Brian Lampkin, who's the Senior Vice President of Digital Imaging and Video, and a brilliant guy. He used to be on the actually Photoshop product management team, and he helped us launch our association a number of years ago. He was kind of one of the guys that helped spearheaded our launch 6 years ago for the NAPP, and he's a brilliant public speaker. And the great thing about it is when you get an executive from the company to talk, it's great if you get a guy that really, really understands and, you know, really knows the users, really knows the products. Brian is that guy. He speaks at a level on Photoshop and digital imaging things that very few CEOs or executive level guys can. And he's a great public speaker, and he always gets the crowd going because he always shows really, really neat stuff.
Photoshop World is really for the person that uses Photoshop from a professional perspective. Is there anything open for people that kind of use it from a amateur perspective?
Well, it's funny that you say that. We get a number of people who we call prosumers. They're not professionals. They're not making their living in Photoshop, but they're pretty good at shooting. They're pretty good at Photoshop, and we have a special day for them. Actually, the second day of the show, which is March 2nd, we open just the expo part to the public, and the public can actually come in. They can watch demos on the floor, meet the vendors, and the exhibitors there are going to be people like, literally, like Nikon, Canon, Fuji, Olympus, of course Adobe is an exhibitor, a lot of plug-in manufacturers, printer makers, Epson and people like that will have exhibits there, and they can watch demos. We've got we have four theaters on the floor all doing different classes and sessions and all, so the public can kind of, if they don't want to go for the whole full-blown three-day 60 class extravaganza, they can't come to the Moscone on that Tuesday.
And
check out the show floor, watch some demos, and just see all kinds of cool, neat Photoshop stuff.
Great. We got a call from Salinas. Arnett, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hello.
Hello, yes. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
What I was curious is we're talking about software at this time, and for someone who wants to start off shooting on a higher end, what type of cameras would you recommend for to look at within a decent price range? I was looking at the EOS Canon, and that's a little high, you know, a little pricey, but same time, what other cameras could you recommend?
Scott, can you hear Arnett, Scott?
I could barely hear something
okay.
about digital
well,
cameras.
Well, yeah, he's just asking. He's looking at the EOS Canon, the 6.2 megapixel, and wants to know if that's a good starter camera for someone that wants to have a good camera.
That camera rocks. Honestly, that camera, it's one of the hottest selling cameras in America. And I shoot Nikon myself. So I don't mind telling you, a Canon product is that great. I'm editor of a Nikon magazine, but you know, he's asking a simple question: is that Canon camera rocks?
Well, there you go, Arnett.
It's a pro quality camera.
All right,
for a non pro quality price.
Great, thank you very much, Arnett.
What would a non pro quality price be?
That camera is probably in the $800 to $900 range. And you might think, ooh, that's a little pricey. But I'm telling you what, it takes a level of photo that you cannot get from a $400 or $500 camera. I mean, not just that it's 6 megapixel, but the glass that comes on that camera, the actual lenses and the, you know, one of the problems that a lot of people don't realize about digital cameras are when you buy a little point and shoot, the size of the lens may be literally the size of a nickel. When you get up to an SLR like that Canon Rebel, you're now talking about a lens the size of a baseball. And that glass makes all the difference in the world. And the other thing about that Canon Digital Rebel, it doesn't really have shutter lag. You can crank off the shots one after another. It's not like, you know, a lot of digital cameras, you press the button, and then a second or two later it goes, click. Not the Rebel. The Rebel's like, it's like having a power winder. It's a great camera in so many ways, and that's why it's probably the hottest digital camera around.
We have a call from Michelle in Iowa. Michelle, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Actually, Michael.
Sorry, Michael. Michael, welcome to GeekSpeak.
My question is, can Photoshop CS do color separations like for a print shop?
Color separations for...
Oh, the question was, can Photoshop do color separations for a print shop?
That's the question.
You know,
Photoshop lives to do color separations. Or a print shop. Yeah, it is. I mean, if you look in a magazine today, any magazine or newspaper, and you see a color photo, you can almost bet 100% the color separations were done in Photoshop.
So basically, how do you export your photo as color separations as four different files?
You go under the image menu, under mode, and then you'll see RGB and different ones, and one of them will be CMYK, which is when you convert to CMYK, you are basically converting that to color separations for prepress.
Okay, and then how do you actually give the file over to the prepress department or the person that's going
to
be
making
your sets?
Well, that's the thing is you have to call whoever's going to separate it, and there's two things that you want to ask. Number one is before you choose CMYK, there are some color settings that the print house, the print shop that's going to print your file will give you. They'll say, hey, go to your color settings in Photoshop, set your black generation to this, set your, I mean, they'll give you the settings. A lot of times they'll either send you a screen capture or fax you exactly the settings to do before you convert to CMYK. That way, when you convert to CMYK, it's perfectly tuned to their particular printing press.
Now, then Scott, would you say that that's a last-minute step on your photo, is to switch over to CMYK?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, do as much as you can in RGB and then switch to CMYK at the end. We do everything that we can. The reason is because when, as long as you're in RGB, you have all of Photoshop's tools at your disposal, every single tool, every single filter. Once you switch to CMYK, there are certain tools and certain filters and stuff that are grayed out. They just go away.
Michael,
so we try to do as much as we can in RGB.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. Was there another follow-up question?
Yep, thank you. No.
Okay, thank you very much for the call, Michael. Sean, you want to get in here with a question for Scott, please.
It was about digital cameras.
Well, go ahead. Let's step back to digital cameras. It's a good subject.
So somebody who doesn't want to spend $800 on a digital camera wants to get something more compact, fit in their pocket. I know the sweet spot now is 5 megapixel, 3x zoom. Seems to be where everybody...
about
$350, $400 camera.
That's it.
What do you recommend in that area?
I like the Nikon 4300. Now, again, I shoot Nikon. So.
Right, you're an editor of a Nikon.
But I'll tell you, I mean, I told you about the Canon, right? I would give you the straight shot.
Sure, sure.
The Nikon 4300 is a very nice, small camera. It's right where you're talking about the megapixels, the price, the 3x optical zoom, the 4x digital zoom, which you never want to use a digital zoom anyway. But it's a. My wife has that camera. My father has that camera. My father-in-law has that camera. I wind up shooting with it a lot on vacations. That is a kick-butt little camera.
Nikon 4400, you say?
I think it's the 4300.
4300.
Great.
Good. Thank you very much for that. Let's talk about another feature that you like in Photoshop. You want to? Do you have one off the top of your head? The new CS. How about? I've got a suggestion for you. Layer comps. Can you talk about layer comps?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Okay, good.
Layer comps are great. They're primarily for probably designers and some photographers. But what it lets you do is it lets you do different layouts. A lot of times you want to experiment in Photoshop. But if you've done one layout and you say, well, I want to look at three or four different layouts of this. Let's say you're doing a magazine cover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every time you, in the old days meaning 3 months ago, before Photoshop CS, you would have to create different documents. You would have, if you were working on a 90-meg document and you wanted 5 different versions, you'd have to make 5 90-meg documents. Now, basically, it just kind of lets you do a version. Like, you save one layer comp, and it shows your cover like it looks. Make a bunch of changes, save another layer comp. Make another bunch of changes, and then you can basically go through them like a slideshow and say, all right, which do you like better, this one or this one?
So it's a good
this one.
So it's
or
to,
this one.
It's to organize your different thought processes on your work.
Oh, that's
and
a really
be able
great,
to present
that's
it
a great
easily.
Way to describe it. It lets you organize and visualize your different thought processes. And then here's the kicker. When you finally all agree on, okay, this is the one we want, it because it actually changes the document internally,
uh-huh.
You can pick up from right at that spot and all the layers are right. In other words, you
very
can
cool.
if we go, okay, we're gonna go with version 4. You don't have to go and try to recreate it. You just start right from where you are, and everything's right in place as it was. So it's pretty brilliant in its execution.
So do you just save it as a different type of file? Or
no, that's the cool thing. You
I
don't
mean,
save it.
What do you do exactly?
It's just open a little palette, and you just save it. You know, it's just, I don't know how it does it. It's magic. Adobe doesn't even know how it works. But I'm totally kidding.
I see. It's a palette under Windows, layer
yeah,
comps.
Yeah, it's just a little floating palette, and it just... There's a little button that looks like the new layer icon. You just change your page around and click OK, and it remembers what it looked like at that point.
That's a great feature. I like how easy to implement. I mean, really, basically, okay, keep a snapshot of this stage. Okay,
yeah,
let's
it's
keep going.
Like that.
Okay, keep another snapshot of that stage. That's wonderful.
But it's not. But the kicker is, it's not just a photograph of what it looked like
right.
that time. It actually changes your document as you scroll through those. Watch the layers palette. It changes all the layers to match what happened at that stage in the process. So if you decide to, we're going to go with version 3. You don't have to go and try to recreate anything or move anything around. You're at what it looked like at version 3.
Does it hold new layers in if you deleted a layer or held?
Oh yeah.
So
oh,
it really is. It is like a copy of the file at that point.
It is.
Which I actually end up doing a lot, which is really kind of frustrating. You know, you save one version and then you go on and then you've done
too.
One thing you like and one thing you didn't like and then you've got to kind of figure out how to put them both into the same file.
Well, that's what I'm telling you. This thing rocks.
That sounds pretty great.
It's great.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxel. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland, and our guest is Scott Kelby, and he has such a long list of things that he does that I won't even go into it again, but he's a Photoshop guru. You're welcome to join the conversation if you'd like to ask questions about Photoshop CS, or the Photoshop World 2004 event, which is coming up just March 1st. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. That's in the 831 area code. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. All right, so we've talked a lot about the CS stuff. Let's talk a little bit more about Photoshop World, what people can expect to go to Photoshop World if you really want to spend the money, which is in the $500 range. In any case, Photoshop World starts the 1st, and it's 3 days, and you said it's, what, 60 different classes?
Yeah, it's $599 for a full conference pass, which gets you into everything. There are there's more than 60 classes, actually. There's more than 60 Photoshop training classes, and it's literally taught by a who's who of the world's Photoshop community. It's literally the best, most creative, most brightest, most inspiring Photoshop teachers that basically just share their inside tips, and it's an amazing thing. I mean, of course, it's my own event, so I can go, it's an amazing thing, but when you get that many people that are so passionate about something like Photoshop, there is an actual buzz in the air. You see people going from class to class. Everybody's walking around with a smile on their face. They're making new friends. They're making connections because you're learning secrets and stuff that people have spent years and years and years to develop, and someone just stands up and goes, hey, here's how to do that thing, and it blows people away.
What kind of class are you teaching? What are some of the subjects of the classes you're teaching?
I'm teaching 4 different classes. I'm teaching one called Photoshop Down and Dirty Tricks, which is based on my Down and Dirty Tricks series of books, which is just a class on the latest Photoshop special effects. That's one class I'm teaching. I'm teaching a class called The Lost Art of Typography.
Oh.
Because people are very concerned about typography when they're laying out like pages, when they're working in InDesign or Quark Express. But when they come to Photoshop, a lot of people don't know the rules of typography. A lot of people are coming over from a photographic background, and they don't know how to set type. So we're going to really show them how to make their type look professional in Photoshop.
Well, tell us right now one of those little tidbits about setting type professionally in Photoshop.
Oh, goodness gracious. There's you know what it is? There's not just one thing. It's literally, it's an hour-long class where I go boom, boom, boom through probably 50 different things.
And
that if you employ at least the top 10 of these, it will make a dramatic difference on how everything looks. But I can tell you one area we're going to cover very greatly is letter spacing. Is the spacing between letters is what's the right way to make your letters look professional. Because you know what? When you see type handled on, if you're watching TV at night and you see NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, CNN, all of their type is perfect. It's right on the money every single time. Every time you see them do anything, their type looks 100% right on the money. But the problem is your average Photoshop user just sets their type at the default. They
right.
don't really
Leaves
ever think about letter spacing or kerning or leading or horizontal scaling, all these things, the tricks that the professionals use to make their type look just right.
And now you're teaching this not from what the tools are. I'm sure you're going to be going over what the tools are in Photoshop to do those kind of controls
right.
for typesetting. But you're also going to be talking a little bit about the philosophy about typesetting, what actually looks good and why it looks good.
Absolutely. This is here's why type looks right. And at the end of the class, I'm even going to go through a thing where I go, here are the fonts to use, here are the fonts that are hot now, and here are the fonts that you want to avoid at all costs.
Okay, what's the font that you want to avoid at all costs?
Well, I just pick one off the top of my head, but Brush Script is one that is overused. In the class, I will show exactly why, because I show examples of why Brush Script shouldn't be used under any circumstances, and then I give some alternatives to it. But that's one of those typefaces that's widely, widely used. And see, on different platforms, Brush Script looks different, so I have to show the typeface so people go, I know that as Avalon Script or something,
right,
you know,
right.
Because there's been so many different versions of fonts out there, but I'll be showing them different ones and why they shouldn't use them and how old and outdated they are and what are alternatives, what are people using today, because what people use today in professional typography are different than what they used 3 years ago.
Right. Yeah, it changes.
So it's kind of a inspirational, change the way you work, think about type kind of thing instead of just click under this menu, click under that menu.
Woody from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. I just want to ask a follow-up, too. I don't want to get off the Photoshop subject, but you were talking a while ago about lenses, and I just want to use the opportunity because your host sounds like such an expert on Nikons as well. I shoot, I'm still shooting film, and I have a lot of Nikon lenses, specifically like the big 80 to 200 2.8, which is a beautiful lens, but it's so large. I'm looking to go digital, but I always was hesitating, thinking, I don't want to use those lenses, and you need that big size to gather the light. And my question is, when you're capturing in a digital camera, though, do you not need the big size? Are they more sensitive than, say, like a film emulsion would be, so you don't need that huge lens to gather the light? And
Scott,
so
can you hear?
Trying to
yeah, I can hear him a little
great.
Bit, yeah.
Can you respond?
Yeah. Actually, I wish I could tell you, because digital is so great, you don't need those big lenses anymore. But sadly, you still need those big lenses.
From the gathering, the light capacity.
Digital photography, I think, is better at reacting to light, dramatically better than traditional film is.
Uh-huh.
And you can shoot in much lower light situations, in my opinion, using digital than you can with traditional film. You can get away with murder sometimes with a digital camera.
With the better cameras.
Yeah, but with a better camera,
sure.
Certainly.
Because that's what I've looked at cameras in the store, and I say, I look at the lens, and I go, oh, that's too small to be any good. But then I was thinking, maybe is that erroneous?
Unfortunately, that still holds true. You know what it comes down to is good glass is good glass.
Right.
And if you're using good quality lenses, it makes a tremendous difference in the image. I mean, it really makes a bigger difference than I think most people realize. And I wish that digital got us around that and you could just slap any old lens on there. But the good thing is, that I can't swear to this, because when I went digital, I bought all new lenses, and I kind of left my old lenses behind.
Yeah.
But I believe that if you're buying like a Nikon SLR, like a D100 or D1X,
right,
a D1H, one of the cool new cameras, that they accept traditional Nikon lenses.
They do. And I was looking at the backs versus getting one that was, you know, smaller, more compact. It had a lens and a big, pretty big zoom range and all. But I kept thinking, oh, I better wait up for the back, because I'm not going to get the same performance out of the smaller lens.
Especially since you have so much invested in the lenses you have, you might as well use those on your new camera.
Right.
So buy a Pro Quality and Nikon, and you can take advantage of those.
I certainly appreciate the advice.
Thank you, Woody, for the call. We're going to jump right into another call. Wally from Santa Cruz. Wally, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Quite well, thank you.
I have a couple questions about the Photoshop CS. I don't have it, so I'm not familiar with it in that respect. The registration process is one that I've heard is different than from previous versions. Previous versions, I know I could install both on my laptop and my desktop. Since I wasn't using two computers at once, there was no...
no need, right?
Right. Yeah, it was... I considered it fair use to have it on two computers. I don't know if it still allows that. The other thing was...
Well, let's get to that question first, Wally.
Okay.
Scott, do you know about the registration process for Photoshop CS?
Yeah, I know a bit about it, and I can speak to that real quickly. The first thing is for some reason, I have no idea why, but the registration process is only on the PC platform, not on the Macintosh platform. So if you have a Macintosh, you're not going through this online registration and all that kind of stuff. It's just on the PC side only. So if you have a Mac, that's not really a concern. If you have a PC, it does allow you, by default, to do two installs. So you can install it on your desktop machine and then on your own laptop, and you're set. So it does give you two installs without having to pay an extra fee.
And what is the extra fee if you were to install? Is it like buying a new license if you wanted to install more than that?
You know what? I hate to say it. I have no idea whatsoever.
Well, there you go, Wally. So you'll be able to do two installs, one on your personal and one on your main. And if you're using a Mac, if you're on a Mac platform, then you don't have to worry about it. Just be, you know, courteous to the software vendor.
Well, thankfully, I'm on the ladder, and that'll work just fine for me.
Great. Well, thank you, Wally, for the call.
One more question.
Oh, yes.
I had read online that Photoshop doesn't allow you to scan money.
Oh, yeah. That's a great subject. Thank you, Wally. We're going to take that and keep on going with it. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
Yeah, Scott, what's up with Photoshop not allowing you to scan money?
It doesn't allow you to scan money. It's just what it is.
How does it do that?
Scanning money is against the law. No, really, here's what the deal is. A bunch has been made about this, about Photoshop doesn't let you scan money anymore. Well, here's the thing is, it's not just Photoshop. For years and years, copiers, printers, all these different devices would give you a, sorry, we can't do that warning. So it's not, everybody makes it like Photoshop's the first product to do this. No, obviously, there's a lot of companies that have had this built into their technology for years. It's now just finally filtered its way down to Photoshop, and people are kind of blaming Adobe, like, this is an invasion of privacy and all. Here's what it comes down to is, do you think that Adobe really wanted to add that to Photoshop?
No, of course. I mean, why?
Do you think that they were sitting around going, we got nothing to do today, let's put some engineers on this? They probably hated and cringed to do it. But the government basically said, guys, we have a serious problem with counterfeiting. I mean, I look at what they've done to the dollars in the United States. They've redesigned them numerous times, the different dollar bills, to make them harder to counterfeit. And it is a serious, serious problem for the government to spend that kind of money on it. And finally, it filtered its way down to Adobe. And you're right. If you scan a photo at 100% size, you are going to, they're basically going to say, no, you can't. However, if you have a legitimate reason to have to scan money. You can go to the Treasury Department. The Treasury Department will give you special dispensation. If you say, look, I'm scanning this money for a particular project that I'm doing for my high school or for whatever, they'll give you special dispensation if necessary to be able to scan money. And there's all kinds of, I'm not going to give you these, but there's a dozen ways around it. There's all kinds of little ways.
And you can do a Google search to find out if you care how to do it.
Yeah, there's all kinds of ways around it, different percentages you can scan at and things that will, that do allow you. But what they don't want you to do is they don't want you to scan a $100 bill at 100% of the size, because why would you be scanning money? I mean, you're reproducing money when you do that, and I know that Adobe didn't want to do it, and I know that a lot of people have gotten up in arms in it because, I mean, basically they see it as an invasion of privacy, but really it's just, it's protecting your country's currency, and that should be something we're all concerned about. So I know Adobe didn't want to do it. Honestly, I can tell you in my career as a Photoshop guy, I cannot tell you if I've ever, ever had to scan money. So it's not a big impact on my life, to be honest with you.
So, this is Sean. I have a question about Photoshop. One of the features in the file menu is to edit in ImageReady. Why would you do that?
For the web. ImageReady basically installs with Photoshop. It's part of the Photoshop experience. And sometimes you'll have an image and you want to go and you want to add an animation. So let's say that you've got a single frame and you think, I'd like to make an animation. If you choose Edit in ImageReady, basically it takes your image, launches ImageReady, and opens up that image so you can manipulate it in ImageReady.
Interesting.
ImageReady is a little-known product that installs right along with Photoshop.
Speaking of web stuff, Photoshop's now exporting stuff as a Macromedia Flash file.
Yep.
What's in the Flash file when you open it up? Is it all the layers or split up into layers or what?
You got me.
Oh, yeah? You don't use that much?
I've never done it.
You're definitely a photo
I'm a Photoshop
person.
Guy. I'm not a Flash guy. Flash is vector, and that scares me.
And the same with Illustrator, right?
Yeah, Illustrator. Now, here's the weird thing. I use Illustrator. It doesn't scare me. Flash scares me.
Huh. Okay.
Things are moving and all, you know.
Good to know.
Very scary.
Other things you use, Final Cut Express, iTunes, iPhoto, things of that nature. What other stuff do you do besides Photoshop, out of curiosity?
I love to edit video. So I'm using Final Cut Pro. I've even used Final Cut Express. I use iMovie. That's like a personal hobby and something I'm starting to get deeper into. It takes longer than Photoshop, so you have to have more of a time commitment for it. But that's something I'm big into is the video editing inside. And now that new application from Apple, GarageBand, that thing can really can tremendous productivity killer, because you think you're going to play with it for 20 minutes, and 3 hours later you're still messing with it.
It is a fun little app.
Yeah,
all right,
it's a blast.
We mentioned text a second ago, and talking about the different classes. But you're doing two other classes. Can you briefly go over those? And we're talking about for Photoshop World.
Photoshop World. Yeah, another class I'm doing is creating. Storybook layouts for wedding photographers. The high-end wedding photographers are doing these things now called storybook weddings, where it's like the next level of wedding photography. It's not just a bunch of photos, but it's actually a book. And the way they design this and the techniques that they use are very slick, and it's all done in Photoshop. Well, I'm teaching them not only how to do these layouts, but how to automate these layouts to where you set them up as templates to where when it's time to shoot the next wedding, you just drag and drop the photos in. It's kind of a clever way to basically put more money in your pocket for wedding photographers. And my goal is when the wedding photographers leave that class that they're going to have literally an unfair advantage against every other photographer in their town, and they're going to be able to do things they never dreamed of doing in a speed and fashion that is going to really literally set them apart. And it's a one-hour class, and when they walk out of there, and I know because I taught this in Miami last year, and I had people come up and go, that changed everything. I'm going to go back, and I'm doing that. That's my new thing. And they knew right then how it was going to affect their competition and what an advantage they were going to have. And that's pretty slick to be able to teach a class like that that really impacts people's careers. So I'm really, really excited. Of all the classes I'm teaching, that's one I'm most excited about. There's a fourth class I'm teaching. I can't remember what it is.
And we're talking about the classes at Photoshop World 2004. There's another 58 of them or so on top of the ones that you're teaching. Photoshop World 2004 starts March 1st and goes to the 3rd, and that is at the Moscone Center in San Francisco. You can find out more information about that by going to www.photoshopworld.com. No, sorry. Yes, Photoshop World?
Yeah, Photoshop World.
Photoshopworld.com.
I'm going there right now myself.
www.photoshopworld.com to learn more about that. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. This morning we've been talking with Scott Kelby. Scott Kelby, when he takes a break from his seven jobs, he enjoys taekwondo, karate, traveling, piano, writing, commercial aviation, and video editing on the computer. Scott, you can learn more about Scott by going to his personal website, scottkelby.com. Scott, thank you very much for being on Geek Speak this morning.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
The geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating in Geek Speak. To those of you that called in, thank you for making Geek Speak what it is. We do this show because of you, and I love doing this show, so thanks for listening. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBH San Otto, or on the web at kusp.org. For Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.